This is Sci-Fi Tech Talk.
Welcome to Sci-Fi Tech Talk, the podcast where we explore the technology of sci-fi. I'm Jeff Sire, and with me today is Julie Keel.
Hello.
And Mike McPeak.
Hello, everyone.
And this week's episode will be covering the 1976 movie, The Man Who Fell to Earth. So the IMDb blurb on it is, Thomas Jerome Newton is a humanoid alien who comes to Earth to get water for his dying planet. He starts a high-tech company to get billions of dollars he needs to build a return spacecraft and meets Mary Lou, a girl who falls in love with him. He does not count on the greed and ruthlessness of business here on Earth, however.
That actually sounds like an interesting movie.
What, it does.
Yeah. Can we watch this?
Yeah.
Yeah.
This one here, it's, okay, it's 76. Remember, people, drugs was a thing in 76.
Okay, to me, this was Easy Rider of sci-fi. If anybody's seen the movie Easy Rider, it's a classic motorcycle movie. Everybody who rides a motorcycle needs to see it. And it's so trippy-dippy, hippie, whatever. It's like, huh? Same thing with this thing. I had total deja vu. It's like, oh yeah, same movie, except different subject.
Yeah.
Okay, I just want to make a point. Like, we did, none of the three of us like this. We know this from our comments to each other on Twitter before we even talked about it. But this movie has 82% on Rotten Tomatoes, and 70%, and that's among critics, and 70% of the people who have seen it liked it. So I guess we are in the minority.
Gratuitous nudity will do that, you know.
Sure.
Boost ratings.
I would imagine this is a big hit among the drug crowd.
Well, they call it a cult classic.
Right.
Now, and I'd like to see their comments, because it's one of those things. I mean, we've watched movies, and I'm sitting there going, oh, God, is it done yet? This one is like, okay, are we there yet? But it's not quite the same feeling, because there was something visually about it that, you know, held my attention. The story, yeah, it's a little hard to, you know, and I'm wondering if they're giving it, you know, props for, you know, the way it was shot, the movie making part of it, not necessarily the story, because there was something that held my attention.
It's, yeah, curiosity. It was like a train wreck. Like I say, the deja vu, the similarities between Easy Rider and The Man Who Fell to Earth is just, I mean, I should look it up. I haven't even bothered to look it up, see if there are any similar people, like directors or writers or producers or movie studios or whatever, because it's so very much in the same genre.
It's just so much that kind of era, right?
Yep, yep.
It's really a product.
But think about it. This is 1976. Am I right? Star Wars comes out next year.
Which one?
Star Wars.
Oh, Star Wars, okay.
I mean, you go from this one year to Star Wars the next year? No wonder Star Wars blew everybody out of the water.
But, like, the whole era isn't indicative of just one movie. Like, this is definitely one aspect of society at that point, right?
Right.
Star Wars is not the same element. Star Wars is a different aspect of that mid-70s culture.
Right.
But this is definitely the post-hippie kind of drug kind of who are we sort of group. So
yeah, and this to me feels like the tail end of the hippie thing, and Star Wars is obviously the beginning of the geekdom era or something. I don't know what you want to call it, but yeah.
Sure.
And let's just be clear here, too. David Bowie is in this movie, and it is his acting debut. And the reason he was the actor, from what I understand at least, is because they asked him to do the music, and he didn't like the deals they were giving him, so he decided to not do the music. I think he was slated to do both the acting and the music, but he's like, yeah, no, I'm not my music. So, and I didn't bother to look this up either. Did this kick off the Iggy Stardust thing? Anybody?
No, Ziggy Stardust, I'm pretty sure, was late 60s.
Okay.
I'll just look it up. Ziggy.
Can't be that. I mean, he was like 20 in this movie. Did he start Ziggy when he was 13?
I thought Ziggy came after this.
Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars, the album, came out in 73. So that era was definitely before this.
Okay. So it was, maybe even in the middle of it. Yeah, okay. Where do we begin?
Before we get to that, I guess, I looked at Wikipedia here, and this is based on a book.
Yeah, which might actually be good.
Well, I think I'd rather read the book because, they've changed. Well, obviously, they always, not always, but quite often change the movie from the book. But this one, it's more or less the same. But he comes to Earth and he's going to try and bring his people to Earth, not take water back, because that's an overused sci-fi trope. All you need is hydrogen and oxygen to make water. You don't need to haul it.
And it's
back.
Not like there's so many, like we've talked about this a bunch of times, there's so many easier ways to get water than to go to a planet and suck it up in liquid form. Like, there's comets flying around. There's all kinds of easier ways to get it.
Do some chemical reactions. Water's a byproduct,
Yeah. And then this one here, in the book, it actually sounds like they name organizations because, we'll get to that. But there's this nefarious organization that, screws things up and you don't understand why or what their purpose is. But in this one here, the CIA arrests him. Because they've been following him since he appeared on Earth. They submit him to rigorous submit him to rigorous tests or whatever. But in the book, he's blinded, and that's why he quits, developing his spacecraft or whatever.
That's an interesting twist.
Yeah, they shoot the eye x-rays in there. And in the movie, it just fuses his contact lenses to his eyes. In the book, he's blinded. It sounds like the book, just by reading the blurb, the book sounds a little more compelling than the movie does. The movie's visual, let's give it that. But I think the book sounds like it has a little bit more meat on the bone.
Yeah, because the theme of the movie from almost the beginning is the alien lands on Earth and discovers alcohol. And, is it pretty much a drunk the entire time he's here. And the end of the movie is him, falling face forward on a table. It was a completely depressing end. And pointless. It was like, what's the point of this movie?
They kept that thread. That thread was in the book, too. But like I say, hopefully they tied it together a little bit better. Rather than just kind of a hippy trippy dippy, meandering down, memory lane or whatever it was.
I have to admit, because this movie was so bad and I knew it was based on a book, I'm now curious about the book because we have several instances of books that are way better than movies.
Given with the book, you have nowhere to go but up. So, maybe it's got a chance here.
Good point.
I just wanted to say that this movie was directed by Nicholas, produced by Michael and Barry, screenplay by Paul. And all of these dudes, I don't think they've ever met any women.
Was that the Bee Gees you just described?
Anyway. No, I'm just saying, all of these guys who were involved, this was possibly the worst written female character
ever.
I have ever seen.
Yeah.
I love you. I'm like, oh, I'm upset. I'm going to cry. And then it was crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, though, I've seen some other Candy Clark movies, and this is basically her role.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Man. It's kind of the duh. I don't know how I want to call it. Not necessarily dumb, per se, but naive, not quite innocent, because believe me, she wasn't innocent in this movie. That kind of character. So, because I've seen a few Candy Clark things right off the top of my head. I'm forgetting what they are. But same sort of character. And she was dating the director at the time. So,
That explains it all there.
Yeah, there you go. So,
makes sense.
Yeah, I do this kind of character. Okay, Phil, just drop your character in here. Although, like I say, again, just reading the synopsis of the book, you see the same sort of things, though, because she introduces him to religion, alcohol, fashion, all this other stuff.
Yeah. Speaking of introducing to religion, I did pick up tones of Stranger in a Strange Land in this book, too. And Stranger in a Strange Land would have come out before this thing. I don't know if it came out before the book was written, but certainly before the movie was made. That whole alien comes to Earth, right?
Right.
and doesn't understand
culture.
Oh, and
comes as a complete innocent.
Right, yeah. So they take him to church, and they, you know, teach him to drink and, you know, all these other things. Plus the trippy-dippy, druggy, all the things. It was like, oh, yeah. So that's there was, I was feeling a bit of brotherhood. Not like it was an offshoot of it or anything, but it was, and it wasn't quite the deja vu of Easy Rider, but it's like, yeah, we're picking up on some of the same types of themes here.
I Googled it quick. Stranger in a Strange Land came out in 61, and the book that this is based on, I think it was 63.
Okay.
Yeah, so they're same time period, though. Yep. So.
Yep. Mm. Oh, gosh, this movie.
Well, yeah, and it's not like, I mean, we've seen some terrible movies. I'm not calling this one terrible, but
it's not Starship Troopers.
No.
I also wouldn't waste 2 hours or 2.5 hours or whatever it was watching it, you know.
Well, and the basic premise of it, I think, is a little stretching it a little, like the guy, like, oh, okay, well, I need to build a spaceship back. First off, how did he get to Earth?
Well, yeah.
Like, he just fell from space into the lake? Like,
yeah. And even when they do show these, like, flashback or the views of the home planet and the home family, and there's nothing – I mean, there's no civilization there. There's one family in what I'm going to call a sod house in the middle of a desert. How did – what? Yeah, like, really, how did he get out of there?
Yeah, and there's no indication of how he got away from there, how he came to Earth.
Or
even
he,
really how he planned on getting back. He was wanted to raise. He needed to raise a lot of money, but to do what, right?
And how did he know that? I mean, he almost fell. I mean, the minute he fell, it was like he knew that he had to raise money to get back. I mean, like one of the first things he does is go to a patent lawyer and come up with. I think they said it was five basic patents. Oh, and I love. Hey, one of the joys of this movie was the throwbacks. You know, oh yeah, these will be awesome for Eastman Kodak. It's like, yeah, what company? Hello? And the cars. Okay, watching some of these cars was awesome. Also, Datsun. Not Nissan.
Oh, yeah.
Datsun was in this show.
I owned a Datsun once upon a time. And then, the other nostalgic throwbacks is his limo with the antenna on the top for his. Did they have cell phones at that time, or was they still doing radio?
It had to have been CB radio.
Something, or, yeah, some business band radio or something to that effect, or relaying it somehow, yeah.
Yeah, the little wing on the hood of, not the hood, the roof of the Cadillac.
Yeah.
That was fun. Also, boat. I'm selling my mom's car. It's a 1993 Lincoln Town Car Executive Series, blah, blah, blah. And I think the thing is a freaking land yacht. Then you get to this movie and see what a 76 Caddy looks like. I'm like, yeah, no, I have a compact car.
Yeah, this thing is like a Freightliner, basically. I had something. What was it? Now my mind went blank, which is not an uncommon occurrence. Now go ahead. I'll think of it eventually.
Yeah. The one thing that I found interesting, and this is going to be a spoiler for a future episode, we're in the middle of reading the book 2132, and there is a civilization there on Mars that is on a rail because it has to stay out of the sunlight. And the alien house in this one is on a rail in a desert in the sunlight with an awning made of canvas. But, you know, but that little tidbit I found because we're reading the book, I was like, you're on a rail and you're dying in the desert. Move your freaking house, you know. Push if you have to.
That's what I was trying to remember. You mean the cheese curd on rails?
Oh, yeah. Cheeto.
Yeah, it looked like a triangular-shaped cheese curd. Yeah. You know, just my mocking their design, I guess. I would have come up with something a little more, you know, aesthetic than the cheese curd.
And it was a family. I mean, seriously, I've seen tents bigger than that. And it was a family of four that they were supposed to be living in. And again, it was on a rail, so I mean, the assumption there is that it's mobile, and you can move it, and it's in the middle of a desert, and it's dying, and there's nobody else around besides mom and the two kids who are left behind, and you're just going, what? And if there were mom and the two kids left behind, and they were the last survivors of everybody on this planet, would you not take them with you? I mean, would you not escape as a family?
Yeah, look, if you're right. If you were the only ones, it'd be way easier to just take them and move to another planet than to go to that planet, get water, and then go back. Like, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and also, you know, get how much water? I mean, what? You know? there's just some real... And maybe, again, here's a case where the book may have been... Because you wouldn't have had those visuals, you would have been able to create your own idea in your mind, and it would have been, you know, a lot different there. But those visuals actually, for me, interfered with the story. It's like,
so what you're saying is there's plot holes in here that you could drive a 76 Caddy through.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, and like I say, just looking at the synopsis of the book, it sounds like it's got less plot holes in it than this thing does. And like I say, I'm pretty sure just by watching this, there was probably copious amounts of drugs being done, because even in the trivia, David Bowie admits that he was doing like 10 grams of cocaine a day or something to that effect, which might explain a lot. So
I don't think any of us is familiar with cocaine, but that sounds like a lot.
Yeah, I'll take, you know, it sounds like, you know, well, you probably shouldn't be doing that much at all, period. But yeah, this sounds like a fair amount.
It's, Okay, we got to mention sex in the movie. I mean, we'll try to keep it on the not explicit
PG
level.
Side.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's like everywhere all the time. I mean, how this doesn't get like an X rating at times is a little beyond me.
Yeah.
You got full frontal of everybody, which is so unusual in American film.
Yeah.
But the whole Mary Lou, you know, the only woman in the entire show that I can remember is had to, or at least is portrayed as coming from some sort of abusive, incestuous background. And in this small town in New Mexico where she was working at a hotel and basically ready to glom on to anybody who'd have her. Your comments about the portrayal of her in this movie and maybe others as being, I mean, it was almost comic. It was such a caricature of an actual human being that it was just comic at points. And some of the sex, I mean, geez, blank handguns? Are you kidding me? And, you know, just the whole, I don't know, that character just, it was so badly done, it wasn't believable. I mean, and it was, yeah, it bordered on offensive. No, it didn't border on offensive. It was offensive at times. It's sex, drugs, rock and roll included.
Well, I suppose they were trying to make her an innocent, but I think all they did was make her a bimbo. I don't
slutty
know. Yeah,
bimbo.
Like I say, slutty bimbo, or it's just, you know,
and I don't like
morals,
to use either one of those words, but boy, when I use them, this is what comes to mind.
When the shoe fits, wear it. Yeah, basically. Yeah, and like I say, she was just kind of, and like I said, he's kind of a Candy Clark does it well, so I guess that's the way it was written. But yeah, I think if they would have had somebody better that was, I don't know how you would have written her.
Oh God,
I don't know that. I don't know that you want her too smart.
The whole scene where she was crying, like essentially at a reading of the will, you know, Tommy, who was trying to take off for home, the planet, and wasn't successful, you know, and so they basically, for lack of a better term, the scene was representative of a reading of the will, and all she was doing is bawling, "I want my Tommy, I don't care about the money, I want my Tommy." I'm like, oh, just shut.
Yeah, she seemed like more like a 12-year-old, or, you know, mentally stunted might be.
It seems like seems like that even I, the you know, have been culturally trained to know slap her, you know.
It's not appropriate, but she may have earned that. Yeah. You know,
it's like, no, she's in hysteria. You need to slap her. You know, it's like, that, yeah, there are so many things about. And as an actress, I'll give her credit. She played the role well. The role sucked, but, I mean, she did carry it off convincingly.
You're very generous.
I know. Because I'm convinced she's a slutty bimbo. So there you go. I hate those words. Anyway.
Sure. Well, and then, too, I mean, you know, we talk about plot holes. I mean, did anyone – was I the only one that was confused? Because, okay, so David Bowie's character befriends the speckled guy – Buck Henry, whatever his character's name was, Oliver Farnsworth. So he befriends him. You know, he's his patent lawyer. He does all this stuff. So at some point, him and his Farnsworth and his bodyguard, who at some point you wonder if we're having a relationship of sort.
That was definitely implied.
Sure. Well, then they get one gets thrown out the window, and I forget what happened to the other one because it was at that point I'm going, what? Okay, so why did they – did they have to get rid of him?
Because he knew too much?
Yeah, I mean, why did they have to, you know, and who was doing this? I mean, you know, some nefarious organization. Was it some corporation that, you know, instead of just doing, okay, and are they implying that all business corporations are evil rather than competing against your competition, you kill them? Or was it some government agency? And then they didn't want him to leave, so they blew up his spaceship. You know, rather than taking the spaceship and using it to, you know, make more money, no, let's blow it up because we don't want people to know that we've got an alien here on Earth or, you know, what? I don't know. At that point, my brain's kind of going sizzle, sizzle.
Yeah, as much as the trippy dippy nature of this show is, you know, meh, the story is not told well either. There are so many times you're like, what the hell? You know, who is this? Why are they doing this? How did we get here? What is the point of this? You know, the story, there's a lot implied in the story. And you're supposed to make a lot of assumptions or you're just supposed to know stuff. And I don't, and I still don't. And yeah, that particular one, you know, these two guys kind of show up out of nowhere and somewhat comically try to throw the accountant, the patent lawyer, out the window, and he bounces off, you know, and then they do it again successfully and, you know, whatever. But
and like, okay, when he bounced off the window, was that supposed to be funny? Like, I found it
funny.
And I'm like, yeah. And then I don't know if that was
let's make murder funny.
Tension. Yeah, like, it just seems so out of place.
It did.
And, like, I don't know if they were just like, oh, my God, maybe he'll survive. Maybe we're supposed to raise tension. But it certainly, I don't know, made me laugh.
I know.
Right.
And that character, too, was kind of interesting. It's like, oh, yeah, somebody walks up to you and offers you billions of dollars to, you know, like, completely change your lifestyle and your ethics and your morals and what all these other things. Would you? Well, probably, yeah. But, you know, that was the gist of that character. That character seemed like it could have been interesting, but they never did anything with it.
Yeah, he could have been tried to be his moral compass or something.
Yeah.
You know, Candace Clark's leading him in one direction. This guy, because he seemed like didn't seem like he was corrupt. He seemed like he was a good guy who,
right,
you know, had a lot of money shoved at him and his lifestyle's changed.
And
he's trying to figure it out.
He also appeared to be knowing what the hell was going on and the consequences of all these things.
Sure.
You know, he had his feet on the ground and he was taking advantage of it as best he could.
Sure.
But that's a good point, because you did not feel that he was corrupt. You did not feel that he was not trustworthy. You did not feel like he was being manipulated or manipulating, you know.
Right.
So
because, you know, at some point they could have had him trying to, like, swindle David Bowie's character. But no, he seemed to be his friend, his, you know, business manager. You know, he seemed to be an ally, seemed to be on his side. Yeah. And the whole thing with throwing him out the window, I guess I was a little distracted by why did you put on the motorcycle helmets with a clear face guard? Were you planning on headbutting the guy? Is this why you put the helmets on? It's just that incongruity. I realize it's small, but it's these. And when you get to the point where you're contemplating small incongruities, you realize your movie is kind of off the rails because now you're pondering stupid crap.
Right.
But why did they put it on with a – I mean, if it would have had a dark face shield so you were hiding your face, but no. Yeah, so then I'm just sitting there pondering that. And then, like you say, they get to the point where they're throwing them on. And it, like I said, I did feel that – it did feel like a comic relief moment when you're trying to murder somebody. It's a little weird. Yeah, so that whole scene just really kind of left me with a WTF moment.
Oh, yeah. There were many of those.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's not the only one. But,
yeah.
You know, like I said, I just didn't quite see what the motivations were for, you know,
yep,
some of this stuff.
And there, Farnsworth made some comment about... he knew it was inevitable. He knew this day would come. And also, before they managed to successfully throw him out the window, he had figured out who it was that was behind it. And, of course, did not share that, so we don't really know, but whatever. And it becomes the kind of thing, by that point in the movie, you don't care who was behind it. It was like, yeah. I mean, you're so disassociated with what's going on that it's just like, you know, okay, they threw him out the window. All right, what's next? I don't know. Let's just move on.
Yeah.
I mean, you certainly don't feel sorry for the guy. You don't feel, you know, you don't.
Right.
It's not like you go, or anything like that. I mean, it's just like, yep. They do.
Well,
they
you're
turn
in such
that.
A complete state of confusion when you're watching this that, yeah, just like, okay, this is I'm just another weird thing that's happening.
Right, basically, yep.
Right. Well, and I'm sitting there thinking, why stop with him? You got a whole bunch of characters here. Let's just start checking them out. Maybe it would make the movie better.
Yeah.
And I did feel a little bad because, like I said, it did seem like he was the one guy that could have maybe, you know, taken – if they would have, I think, done the movie properly, the one guy that could have maybe been his salvation.
But. This movie I would actually like to see a remake of. Not
yes.
Like this, though. You know, yeah, because the basic premise of, you know, an alien who comes to Earth looking to save his planet in some fashion – it doesn't have to be water theft you know, and gets caught up in, you know, earthly businesses and earthly pleasures or earthly vices and, you know, fails to return to the death of his own planet, you know. That could make an interesting show, but not the way it's done here.
Right. I would say less drugs behind the scene. Maybe a little less nudity because it kind of, you know, I understand he's supposed to be discovering things, but it, at some point it was like, wow, he's, you know, this Rip Torn has a real sexual appetite there. I really didn't
that
even
was
know that.
So gross. I'm sorry.
The college professor banging.
Oh, wow.
Did I hit a nerve?
I just wanted to say something about, you know, because we hear all of this stuff today. Kind of like about how great the morality of the past was and all that. And when you look at stuff like this, I don't think people are really remembering the past accurately.
As has been proven time and time again, we only remember it nostalgically. We do not remember it as it was.
Yeah, like this guy idea that morality is going to hell in a handbasket. And yet movies like this, where there was so much just, you know, casual, you know, treating women like, you know, pieces of meat, and then just casual nudity. And like if this movie came out as is today, just the way it is, the hue and cry would be, oh, you know, this is, you know, how bad society is has become today. And look at how we've gone downhill. Like, yeah, I just thought that was weird when I was watching it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that was. Yeah. That was, there's a couple of things. Well, I mean, basically, that whole sexual harassment on campus was just accepted. I mean, that was just, yeah, whatever. And it, you know, and they're like, there was some, like, supervisor at the college who mentioned his womanizing or whatever and said, you know, you really need to, you know, kind of rein that in. Very casually.
Right.
You know, just
wink,
very,
wink,
yeah,
nudge, would, nudge.
Yeah, just, you know, keep it under control as opposed to, sir, let me read you your rights.
Sure.
Yeah, that was probably, like I say, probably more. There was much of this because it is from the 70s that, you know, the whole your wiener doesn't look like daddy's. it's like, okay, we've got incest and sexual abuse going on there. So, you know, that was just a casual comment that nobody. It just flew right on by. Like, that was just commonplace. It's like, just right on by. It's like, okay.
Well, they had sex and drugs, and you had a rock star in there. Maybe if they would have thrown some, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, maybe you could have made a more interesting, I won't say better, but maybe a little more interesting movie. But, yeah, as it was just kind of weird and off the track. And, yeah, and that whole... because I know Jeff had tweeted it out. I think I'd managed to block it out. Thank you for bringing that memory back to me about daddy's, you know, whatever. And it's like, wow, that's just kind of like, okay, whatever.
Oh, yeah, I've forgotten about that. When she first pulls back the sheets and looks at him and she says, oh, my daddy's look different or something.
Right.
Like, oh, my God.
I know.
Yeah.
I know.
I'd block that out. Oh, yeah. Mike, you are a very bad man.
Well, you're the one that tweeted it out, dude. Julie's the one that reminded us. Let's blame her. You know, she's the woman. She'd take the blame for this.
Yeah, that's it.
As long as we're going back in time, we're throwing you under the bus.
Yeah, it's me. I've corrupted you both. Here.
Yeah, we were innocent. Yeah, it's you. Yeah, you're Candy Clark, so there you go.
Anyway. The tech. There was just a smattering of tech here and there. Not much. The alien planet scenes were interesting, in a cheesy fourth grade type of way. You said, it looked like a cheese curd on rails. It was in like a triangle shape, which also means that with four humanoid forms, it was not livable. You could not live in that house. You couldn't stand up in it. It truly was a tent on a rail, with windows and an awning. Anyway, so that bit of tech was both curious and stupid. The one bit of tech that got my attention, there was early on a musical device that looked like, oh, what did it look like? It was like maybe the size of a drum, like a snare drum. And where the skin of the snare drum should be, it was a cone shape. It was like, it was more than just convex or concave. It was, you know, cone shape. But what they did is they put a steel ball bearing in the middle of that thing, and it played music.
Oh, okay.
And I'm like, oh, that's an interesting thing. And then to change the music, you would just simply put in a different ball bearing. That was to me, that was the single most interesting scene in the entire movie. I don't know where that concept came from. I've never seen it before. It seemed like it was kind of the way it was portrayed in the movie, it was just kind of this thing. I mean, it wasn't unusual at all. And like I say, I've never seen anything like that before in any of the sci-fi movies we've read, looked at, whatever. So that kind of stood out.
Yeah, there was a one, you know, that bright spot. And then their take on, it wasn't quite digital cameras, but it was instant film cameras. Because at one point they take the roll of film out and they pull it out. And I thought, oh, God, she's overexposing the film. No, there's your pictures on a roll. And I thought, well, that's an interesting idea.
That's true. Camera technology, his fortune to a large extent. Again, he came up with these basic patents. Now, I don't know how you can copyright a basic thing that's already been in use. I mean, there was a bit of a plot hole there too, as far as, you know, he's coming in to patent something that everybody's already using and is commonplace. That's not allowed. You can't patent like water, you know, that kind
of
stuff.
Yeah, it has to be distinct.
Yeah, so, but, you know, skipping over that, the fact that it was tied up with Eastman Kodak, and then, he started these cameras that wound up being the disposable camera of that era. And in 76, I don't even know where cameras were back at that point. Polaroids had to have been a thing, because that was in the 60s. We probably weren't yet to disposable cameras.
I remember having a 110 film camera with a cartridge in it.
We certainly weren't to digital. I mean, absolutely we're not to digital. No way. So, yeah, that whole idea of instant photos like that. And Polaroids, you know, you'd have to, you know, wave around to dry them off, and it would take, I don't know how many minutes or whatever amount of time.
I remember my dad having a Polaroid camera like that in the late 70s. So that would probably be around the same time.
Yeah. So this idea that you could, like, literally pull the film out of the camera and, you know, pull it out of the cartridge, and it would be developed. Is that the word?
Yeah. Yep. Sure. Yeah.
This old school technology developed? that would have been science fiction-y in 76. I'm pretty sure that would have been a... How did they do that type of thing?
Or it would have seemed really modern.
Right.
Right.
Like, it would have been something that I'm sure was probably out by that time, but it probably wasn't something that the average person could buy.
Right.
Probably something that you'd heard of.
Right. Well, you know, and the problem I had with it was that apparently it looked like you had to use up the whole roll before you could pull it out. And you know, I would have had something where, well, then it would have been like, you know, the Polaroid, but something where you take a picture and it pops out. But I thought, you know, the idea that you had a canister you put in there and then your film just, you know, comes out. And, you know, the way they did it, because like I said, with the Polaroid, it popped out, you had to wave it, and then some of them you had to add the stuff you smeared on there to coat it and keep it that way, and you had to wait for it. This was not... I mean, it looked like he had to wait for the roll to fill up, but it was otherwise instantaneous.
Yeah, and it printed out stuff that looked like photo booth, you know, type prints.
Right, the little on the roll thing.
So, yeah. But that was, I mean, I got the impression there were other things in his portfolio, but those cameras basically made his fortune for him because they were kind of like everywhere by the end of the movie. Yeah, so that was kind of a strange bit of technology. What else was in there?
Well, most of the tech is what I would call hand-waving tech. It's like, we have this thing, just, you know, go with it. Don't worry too much about it. You know, like some of his, again, his patents, they were, except for, you know, maybe the film stuff, and I don't know, was there another one? He supposedly had like 9 patents or something. It was just like, they're patents. They're going to make him a ton of money. Don't worry about it too
much.
Right,
yeah, like all the money, and nobody's going to care, you know. And everybody's going to be... There were no paparazzi in 76, apparently, because anybody that rich is going to draw a crowd, especially if they're that trying to be that reclusive. I mean, you'd have to have a fortified compound to have any sort of privacy with that much money.
Well, yeah, like Howard Hughes, because he's the famous recluse. And when did he die? It seemed to me like late 70s, I think. So I don't know if they were trying to like model him or not. But yeah, I mean, he hold up in different places. And
you got the impression that it was Tommy and Mary Lou, and then possibly a chauffeur, one other person, and then the business partner, and that was it. I mean, that's like basically.
Right, his entourage.
Yeah, the entourage. There was no, you know, staff of servants or whatever. So, yeah, there's just...
Well, and then his chauffeur apparently can be bought, because he's the one that, instead of taking him back to the space capsule to go into space, they take him off to wherever, to that hippy-dippy trippy place that they did research on him.
And that's the other bit of technology, I suppose, would be his contact lenses, because he had cat eyes, except he wore human-looking contacts. But yeah, we got to talk about that bit. This whole, he's being held prisoner in a hotel that's got like 15 rooms, all with different themes that you have to go through to get there. And then he's just basically on a bed in a back room that nobody knows about except the one guy who brings him food like once or twice a day. And what?
Well, was that first room that you went into, was the theme supposed to be derelict, rundown building, or was it just that way? Because like I say, you walked through different ones. They had like a room with, and I remember that being a thing in the 70s, God, with like, was it the camel wallpaper or the outdoor?
Yeah, the fall foliage mural.
Yeah, I've seen that a few places, yeah.
Yep.
Let's not go back there.
There was a modern retro room and whatever. So yeah, and a big seems to me there's like a medieval looking room. So yeah, it was interesting, and I can understand that sometimes the best place to hide somebody is like out in the open, in a place like a hotel rather than a government facility or something. But you got the impression he was there. Well, no, you didn't. You were given the impression, they were reinforcing the impression that he was there for decades because he didn't age. Tommy didn't age, but Mary Lou did. And so did the other. What we haven't talked about is Rip Torn's role. Yeah, he was a scientist. There were two people on the planet who knew what he was, at least at the start. Mary Lou was one, and Rip Torn, who was a scientist of some sort, was the other. I don't know that the business accountant even understood, the patent lawyer even understood that he was an alien. So it was limited to just those two. But yeah, the whole idea that decades had gone on and he was in this hotel and they would bring him food on a daily basis and that kind of stuff, but nobody would find him. Nobody had any curiosity of what was going on back there or where this food was disappearing to or whatever. Maybe. I guess, actually, as I'm sitting here going, maybe, I'm like, no, that's possible, because people have been held captive by their parents, even, in their own basements for decades, and nobody's bothered to notice that, they buy more food than one person could eat, that kind of stuff. So, yeah, no, that's, yeah. I suppose that's extremely possible.
Well, there is one other thing that this movie didn't really play into it, but, like, and a lot of movies don't, but if these are aliens, we often in movies end up treating them just like, well, they act just like people do. So if they're an alien who are coming to this with a complete alien agenda and no understanding of our customs and culture and everything, they might never even realize that they were a captive.
True.
They might not even have a concept of captivity.
Right.
They're just like, oh, okay, we're hanging out here now. And like, it could be very possible that after 10 years, like, okay, I guess I'm going to leave, and that they might have some sort of ability that they were never really there against their will anyways, because they could have left at any time because they were able to do whatever, they were strong enough to get free or whatever, right?
Yeah.
But in so many of these movies, we treat these aliens just like they're humans who just, like Star Trek, like they're the aliens who have weird hands and heads. But they act exactly like every human.
Right.
They have the same kind of very, very similar culture to us, very similar outlook on the world and, like the way things work. Whereas like a movie like Ender's Game, the aliens are really alien because they're a hive mentality and they never figure out what their motivation is until Ender does at the very end, right?
Right. And actually, going back to Star Trek, that's the most scary parts. I mean, that's what makes them scary, is when they don't behave like humans. The Borg
come to
mind. But
like in Star Trek, like there's very few times, even in Star Trek, where they really act alien.
Right. Right?
Tanagra one where their language is so different because it has a completely different structure. That's something original. The aliens where they don't have a gender, that was really different. But for the most part, they're just they're bipedal. They're bisymmetrical. They're like, they're very similar to us, and then they're very similar, you know, looking to us, and then they're very similar to us in their kind of culture and outlook and everything.
Right. Yep. Yeah. No. And I agree that that's something that we started. Science fiction does. I mean, that's why, to me, that's one of the reasons Ender's Game stood out, is because they actually did have an alien. You know,
And I think we've talked about this before, but I think it's one of the things that, for the most part, science fiction, as much as we're talking about the future and everything, it's really used as a vehicle to examine ourselves, right? Oh,
absolutely.
Yep. Yeah. Well, and let's not forget, in this movie, I think they kept him either drunk or drugged half the time.
Well, and we say they kept him. You know,
or they supplied it. Maybe
certainly
maybe kept himself.
Yeah. Because after seeing this, you had to read something to go, what the hell just happened? You know,
well,
and they were saying that he became addicted. You know, it wasn't necessarily intentional, but because his planet, you know, didn't even have water, why in the hell would they have alcohol? So,
well, then at one point, I'm trying to remember if I imagined this, because at this point, I'm going to anything to, you know, kind of keep this movie going along. At one point, it seemed to me like he got up, walked to the back of the room, and said, "Oh, there's a door back here." You know, then he walked through it and he was able to get out. I mean, did he not?
Well, like, what I read on that was that, you know, he
I didn't imagine this.
Worst CIA guys ever.
Yeah. See, and that to my point, but that's what I read of that scene was that. He had been there so long that the hotel had basically crumbled around him, and he realized that nobody was still out there guarding the door, or the locks had failed or whatever.
Okay.
So he'd been there long enough that it had just, you know, he'd been forgotten and had crumbled. Which, again, who's bringing him booze and food? I mean, you can't forget him and still have him live, you know. So, yeah. But that was weird.
It's best not to read too much into this movie.
Oh, definitely.
You're going to get a headache. Yeah.
Yeah, this is not a tightly written plot at all.
No, I think alcohol for the watcher may actually help this movie some.
Yeah, that's a good.
This would be an awesome movie if you were on acid.
Yeah,
yeah. We're not advocating the use of drugs, but this movie kind of makes you think about it.
Yeah,
yeah. Because maybe if your mind was in a let's go with alternate reality. maybe it would seem you wouldn't contemplate why there are certain parts of this movie that you want to go what or huh or even punch people.
Again, you know, I don't regret watching this movie. I don't think I want to watch it again. I don't think I want to recommend people watch it. But I don't absolutely frickin' hate it either. You know, it was just kind of. I mean, if it had been, this was like 2.5 hours too. It was over 2 hours, and it could have easily been done in 90 minutes. And
that. Go ahead.
Well, I'm just going to go back to my argument that it does seem ripe for a remake. I mean, I think there's enough to the story there that it would be interesting to do well.
I'd say if you haven't seen. Like, if you haven't seen it, you're not missing anything. But if you've never seen it, and anything that we've said piques your interest, you might very well appreciate it.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to see a naked David Bowie, watch it, you know.
Yeah.
So,
what does David Bowie wiener look like?
Yeah, well, there you go.
This movie will answer your question.
I could have lived without that. And to your point, I know that this movie was 2 hours and 19 minutes because I kept checking it.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you're like some sort of a filmmaker or somebody that's interested in this kind of stuff, like I said, there's just something I can't quite put my finger on, but something about the way it was shot, some of the scenes, and I'm by no means any sort of film student, but there was just certain things about it that at least that held my attention when the story was kind of, you know, dragging along. So if you have some sort of appreciation, I guess, for, you know, how a film is shot or some of the techniques they use or something like that, you may be able to get something like that from this movie, because like I said, I think that was the thing that just kept me from going all, you know, Starship Troopers on this thing, was just there was something about the way, like say, the movie, the shots, you know, some of this stuff was done that just
it feels like an art film.
Yes.
Yeah.
Very much so.
Maybe that's what I'm trying to say. But yeah, there is that kind of artsy feel to it that if you appreciate that sort of stuff, you might do okay with this movie.
Yeah. Yeah, it's It's a, you know, I don't know. One of the reasons it made our list is because it was highly recommended on there, and it's kind of a cult classic. So I'm not opposed to going back and looking at old science fiction. It's kind of interesting, actually, to see how it's changed. Right. But one of the things that we were talking about just a few minutes ago is the fact that science fiction usually is trying to tell us something, and I have no idea what this movie was trying to tell us. I don't know what the message is from this.
Well, messages is probably don't do drugs, don't look at your daddy's wiener. maybe getting that kind of messages. Yeah, maybe not.
I'm afraid the message is things like women are stupid bimbos and, you know, men can control everything and that business is evil and aliens are I don't know what the messages are. I really don't.
Or the other message is if you see guys with business suits and motorcycle helmets run.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, I mean, I usually don't regret watching, you know, any of the movies or you read the books that we watch here, because it does open my mind, make me think a little bit, and I try to keep my, you know, self open to other ideas. But yeah, this one, like I say, I wouldn't go back and revisit it, but you know, it's a movie, and it has a place in history. Like I say, it's a cult classic. David Bowie, sure, Rip Torn. Even the guy, you know, I've seen him around, and I was kind of surprised to see him in there, this Bernie Casey, you know, the black guy that was in charge of...
Yes. Oh, let me... Thank you for bringing that up.
Okay.
Black man, white woman, 70s?
I know, saw that.
That was a little racy.
Progressive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was a little bit thing. But the only thing, the way it was portrayed in the movie, this was a very rich black man.
Sure.
So that stood out a little bit as like, really? Given everything else that's being portrayed in this movie about, you know, sexism and business and whatever, that was a little notable.
Well, yeah, rich black guy that has some power because he's like ordering people around. And like I say,
is he the guy that ordered the hits?
He's ordering people around. So yeah, you know, maybe on the downside they're making him kind of ruthless, but you know, like I say, given the fact of the way they're treating women and you know everything else, that did kind of stick out to me just a little bit, that there was one thing in here, I won't quite call it redeeming, but at least it skipped a stereotype or two, and hey, let's go a different direction with this one. They would have done it a few more times, the movie would have maybe been a little better. But I will give them credit for at least not grabbing that stereotype.
Yeah. That, like I say, that was notable as a whoa. Because this, well, I guess, you know, the whole interracial kiss thing from Star Trek was almost 8 years earlier. So it's not the first time, and maybe it was starting to get a little more accepted, but that one really did kind of jump off the screen as whoa, just given the whole feel of the rest of the movie.
Right, yeah, and you know, I kind of remember that times, because at that point I would have been, 14 years old, and so my view of race relations was the TV. So I will admit, I've lived an insular life, you know, in the community that I live, just because of the makeup of it. So, you know, for me to see something like that, given the times that I've seen through the TV set, it did kind of grab my attention, because they weren't addressing issues too much like this on TV. And when they did, like I say, it was Star Trek, and there was probably a few others. I think, didn't the Jeffersons have an interracial couple on there?
Yeah.
But it wasn't the kind of thing that that wasn't really catching on. It hadn't become popular. I don't know what term you want to use. But, yeah, so for them to do that at this time, it was a little progressive or forward-thinking or something.
Pretty much broke a lot of other norms here. I mean, you're talking sex, drugs, race.
Right.
They did play to the sexism mainstream, whatever, but the rest were kind of fringe. So,
sure.
Yeah. Interesting.
Well, is there any tech you guys would specifically like to have from this?
I'll take the music device. I really will. That looked both visually looked cool and technically. I still got to think about how that might actually work. I mean, because it almost was like a speaker. I mean, that device they were sitting it in was almost like a speaker. And so if your music was in the center of it and it was somehow vibrating, that could actually be how you produce music. So, yeah, I kind of like that one.
Yeah, I'll kind of go with Julie on that one, too, because the camera, the way it worked, seemed a little clunky, you know, slightly interesting for the times, but still kind of clunky. But the music thing did, it had a certain visual appeal to it. And I do like things visual once in a while. And so I do kind of like design and style and that kind of stuff. So that did, you know, just the way it looked there. And like I said, in the middle there, and you threw the ball in there. And so then I could just see somebody casually walking by and tossing a ball in there and listening to music. So that intrigued me.
I did like the idea of some way to travel between worlds, but I think I would like a little bit more description of how it works before I tried it myself.
Yeah.
But
I'm still kind of perplexed by the idea that he needed a spaceship to return but didn't really appear to bring one with him on the outbound.
That seems like something you would probably think about before you went on your trip.
Yeah, you know. I don't know.
Well, yeah. According to the description of the book, they said that they're a super intelligent well, maybe they thought, well, we'll figure out when we get there. But you still think super intelligent would have a better plan than this?
Yes, you would.
Yes.
Well, that wraps up this episode of Sci-Fi Tech Talk. You can check us out at scifitechtalk.com and pop into the forums there and take part in the conversation. Or you can follow us on Twitter at Sci-Fi Tech Talk. If you have ideas or comments, please send them to greetings at Sci-Fi Tech Talk, and reviews on iTunes are always welcome. Julie, where can people find you?
I can be found on Twitter at Julie Keel, J-U-L-I-E-K-U-E-H-L, and links to the other blogs, podcasts, and whatever else I have going on can be found at about.me/Julie Keel.
And Mike, what about you?
I can be found on Twitter at DSC Chipman, and for my other things that I do, you can check me out on about.me at about.me/Mike McPeak. That's M-C-P-E-E-K.
Cool. And people can follow me on Twitter at Bronco Sire. That's S-Y-E-R. Next episode, we'll be covering the 1981 movie The Road Warrior. In a self-destructing world, a vengeful Australian policeman sets out to stop a violent motorcycle gang. Is this The Road Warrior or is this Mad Max?
Both.
Oh. Oh, is it called something different in the States? So this is the original movie?
Yeah, it's Mad Max, you know, The Road Warrior.
Oh, okay. Excellent. Well, that's it for the show. We'll see you in the future.
Quirky matter. Quirky matter. It's the Sci-Fi Tech Talk.